You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a production of WVIK Quad Cities NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today I'm very, very pleased to have as my guest this week Rick Perlstein, the author of an epic series of books that tell the story of the rise of the modern conservative movement in American politics. His books include Before the Storm, which focused on the rise of Barry Goldwater to the Republican nomination in the early 1960s, Nixonland, which examines the comeback of Richard Nixon and the deep cultural divide that defined the 60s and also continues to this day, The Invisible Bridge, which looked at the period between Nixon's fall and Ronald Reagan's rise, and his latest book, Reaganland, which examines the Carter presidency and Ronald Reagan's 1980 victory for president. I'm going to attempt the impossible, which is to adequately cover his latest book and parts of the previous ones within a half-hour show. Ain't going to happen, but we're going to try. Rick, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Robin. Big Quad Cities fan. Go River Bandits, and looking forward to racing through this.
Great. Well, these are, to our listeners, this is an outstanding series of books. It's not just because I lived through this period. This is just really good history that encompasses a lot of other topics which I think what great history is all about, and I'll cover some of those topics in our interview today. But I've had several authors of recent books on the rise of Trumpism on offered their thoughts on when it all started. Some say it goes back to Reagan. Others say Gingrich, Sarah Palin. After reading your books, especially that first one, I wonder if it doesn't go all the way back to Barry Goldwater. What are your thoughts on that?
I've been taking it back to 1787, Robin.
Even further.
Basically, by which I mean this. I mean the original kind of compromise that allowed us to have a United States, of course, was this giveaway to the South, having a Senate, right? No matter how many states citizens of state had, they got two senators, an electoral college, and then, of course, the terrible three-fifths clause, all of which basically guaranteed that kind of the most reactionary part of the country would always have a veto over how the government was run, and basically set up a precedent where sort of the reactionary minority believed they had a kind of right to rule the country. So to me, that's one of the deep foundations of, you know, kind of American right-wing politics. And certainly the direct lineage of Donald Trump has all sorts of way stations all over that kind of 250 years, whether it's, you know, not too far from you guys, you know, Reverend Owen Lovejoy having his abolitionist newspaper's printing press thrown in the, you know, Mississippi River, you know, by a mob directed by kind of the elites of the town in Illinois, you know, or Reconstruction, or, you know, the 1920s Ku Klux Klan, which, don't forget, you know, ran state houses in a couple of states and had millions of members and, you know, marched down Pennsylvania Avenue and had a very QAnon-like conspiracy theory at its core that Catholics were kind of this invisible army that was getting ready to take over the United States. And then we get to the modern, you know, post-New Deal right, when the signpost, of course, was the rise of Joseph McCarthy, of which, you know, the Republican establishment was perfectly happy with until he got a little embarrassed, too embarrassing, and then they jettisoned him. But then, yes, the rise of Barry Goldwater, which kind of began to complete the institutional takeover of the Republican Party by the conservative movement. And that was, you know, one of the most striking developments in American history. I've been quoting a lot one of Barry Goldwater's delegates to the 1964 convention after they won the convention. By the way, with kind of minority support, they really did sort of take over the party through something like a conspiracy. And one of his delegates said, "We just pushed the Mason-Dixon line straight up to Canada." So to me, what that signifies is a lot of the kind of reactionary, minoritarian, white supremacist policies that had become dominant in the South began kind of spreading all over the nation with the Republican Party as their vessel.
Along those lines, the issue of race just permeates mm-hmm. through this whole story from the early 60s to this day. And the Democrats continue a debate. I've had different people on my show talking about whether cultural factors, including race and immigration, fostered the movement of the white working class to Republicans, or whether it was just more economic factors that might account for all the Obama-Trump counties here in the Midwest. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a real kind of chicken and egg issue. One of the really interesting things that historians have pointed out, that's kind of the reason we have many social democratic kind of liberal institutions at all, things like Social Security, things like unemployment insurance, the things we got from the New Deal. They attributed that, and I'll name a historian named Jefferson Cowie, who mm-hmm. wrote a wonderful book called The Long Exception, to the fact that the very Republican Party run by the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s was able to pass an immigration bill that shut down most immigration to the country, and that it kind of took race off the table in the 1930s in a lot of ways, that people were able to kind of vote their class consciousness because they didn't think that they were kind of giving away, too much to non-white Americans, right? So there's always been this issue that it's been very hard for Americans to kind of think in terms of solidarity, in terms of everyone being in the same boat and the government helping everyone, without that distraction of race. And one of the economic, one of the ways in which economics plays into that is in times of, economic anxiety. And it doesn't necessarily mean that, it's poor people voting for Trump, but just the idea that sort of like what you have might be taken away because, the marketplace is more harrowing and frightening than it had been. You tend to see more ethnic scapegoating, right? I mean, it's not an accident that Hitler was able to rise in Germany at a time when they had, hyperinflation, right? So when people don't know where their next meal is coming from or whether their business is going to be foreclosed, it's a lot easier to kind of blame it on someone who doesn't look like you. So you can't take race out of the equation, but, it really helps to kind of keep a stable sort of liberal kind of governing structure going when the economy is humming along nicely.
To get one of the myths you talk about in your book, and that's what I love. I've one of the joys of interviewing book authors is finding out how sanitized our teaching of history is.
Oh my God!
But if you were to go out and ask 9 out of 10 people that lived through that era, or ask 10 people, 9 would say that the reason Carter lost, one of the main reasons, was because of the Iranian hostage incident. And even Jimmy,
I have a revisionist account of that, don't I?
Jimmy Carter is one of them. I heard an interview where he was with his media guy, Jerry Rafshoon, where he listed 3 factors, and that was one of them. You kind of take issue with it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it doesn't terribly surprise me that Jimmy Carter would say that, because then he's basically saying that it was something that it was out of his hands, right?
Yeah.
But I found a very interesting data point. It's really interesting doing this research and actually kind of looking and seeing the documents from the time and often how they reveal a picture that's a lot different from what we remember, just like you point to. And NBC and the New York Times did a massive exit poll, so the most massive that had been done at that time, 13,000 people interviewed all over the country as they leave the polls. And they said, what are the 2 biggest issues that caused you to vote for who you voted for? And the 5th biggest issue, and the first issue, by the way, that wasn't an economic issue, was, the Iran hostage crisis. But of the people who said that was one of their most important issues, they voted for Carter by a ratio of 2-1. And what to me that signifies is it's really easy to forget, because the world didn't blow up between 1980 and 1988, was how many people were afraid of Ronald Reagan as someone who was just not someone who they trusted with their finger on the nuclear button, right? There was this fear that if Ronald Reagan became president and the hostages were still there, he might start another Vietnam to get them out. I think in a lot of ways, Jimmy Carter handled the hostage situation with the coolness and maturity and foresight, and they weren't harmed. And a lot of the reasons they were taken in the first place was a lot of actually very establishment Republican people like Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford absolutely begged him to let the Shah come to America for medical treatment, something Jimmy Carter did not want to do. when he was advised to do it in a meeting with his advisors, he said, "What are you going to do if they take our embassy workers hostage?" So he really saw this as a danger, and very reluctantly did this. But it turned out to be one of those events that changed the course of history. For one thing, it signified the rise of this new force in world politics of militant Islamic extremism.
You bring up the questions about Reagan, and again, I lived through that period, and I remember clearly the Chicago Sun-Times had a special Sunday supplement, that political piece that talked about his $90 billion cut in the budget, which they described as an albatross. It just got
right,
me thinking about
1976 when he ran against Ford.
Yeah, I mean, and that was replayed some later. But the fear of him, and it really emphasizes how you describe very well how the center of the Republican Party for many years was with the what you want to call moderate liberal wing. They actually had liberal Republicans back then.
Yes, you did. In fact, a lot of them lost their seats during the course of the book because of the, kind of organizing by right-wing activist groups that used, very underhanded techniques of the sort that we associate with the Trump movement now. You talk about that 1976 run. There was, an incumbent Republican president, Gerry Ford, who took over from Richard Nixon. And, Ronald Reagan did something very daring. He decided that Gerald Ford was, a quisling. He was a rhino, what we now call a Republican name in name only, and ran for president against him. And, came within a hair's breadth of defeating Gerald Ford. He took it all the way to the convention. And one of the things that you mentioned that was very interesting in that campaign is he lost the New Hampshire primary. And the reason was he was very forthright about his plan to make massive budget cuts. And Ford's people were able to say, well, that means there's going to be tax cuts for you. New Hampshire hates taxes. You know, it's a state with no state income tax. He said, if Reagan does this as president, you're going to have to pay a state income tax. And from that point forward, Ronald Reagan's operatives, the people running his campaign, were much shrewder about what kind of positions they put out there. In fact, one of the people I focus on the book, giving him a little more credit for Reagan's rise than a lot of historians, is this guy named Richard Wortman, mm-hmm. who is this absolutely brilliant pollster, who came out with a 150-page election plan for the 1980 election called the Black Book that we used like really sophisticated computer modeling techniques. It was not just like Reagan was kind of saying whatever he liked off the cuff. There were focus grouping commercials. There were focus grouping Carter commercials. That Carter campaign didn't even do that. And the funny thing is Richard Wortman in 1981 won Advertising Age's magazine's Ad Man of the Year for selling the nation Ronald Reagan after they had rejected him so resoundingly in 1976.
You're listening to Heartland Politics podcast on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is author Rick Perlstein, who's written four books on the rise of the modern conservative movement, the latest, which just came out recently, Reaganland, America's Right Turn, 1976 to 1980, where I'm having a lot of fun, if you can tell. This is really interesting because I grew up during this period. A couple fun questions here for me anyway. One of the key points in your latest book, I still remember vividly, Rune Arledge, a name out of the past, the former head of ABC Sports, for those who may not remember, was named the new head of the news division. And we talk about how news has changed so much from the Walter Cronkite era, and there you go.
He was kind of like, one of the guys who is responsible for how frivolous news has become, how unserious it's become. What a fun guy to write about. He was the head of ABC's sports division, and not only that, he was the guy who kind of turned even kind of sports coverage into a much more kind of cartoonish, kind of professional wrestling style thing. People of a certain age, I mean, I was born in 1969, and I was glued to my TV every Saturday for this show called Wide World of Sports.
Yep.
And anyone who will hear that will remember the theme song blaring in the background, the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. And the title sequence with this kind of thrilling music, they had this guy, do you remember? It had a guy being bucked off a Bronco and a guy falling off a ski jump.
Yeah.
Like anything, if it leads, it bleeds. That was Rune Arledge, right? And he took over ABC News because they were just desperate for ratings. The news station, the news parts of the network traditionally lost money intentionally. You know, they were just supposed to be these kind of serious, kind of eat your spinach kind of operations that were the network's way of telling the federal government that they deserved their very valuable privilege of owning these public airwaves, controlling these public airwaves. And Roone Arledge, you know, immediately turned the news into entertainment. And he saw the hostage crisis as this marvelous opportunity to kind of stage this national soap opera, really, focusing on the hostages' families, you know, interviewing the hostages' mothers and wives, and, you know, just absolutely reveling at the chance to get them to kind of cry on camera, and turning it into this kind of American sentimental narrative of victimhood. And I, you know, I read a book by one of the hostages' wives, and she thinks that that kind of coverage made it harder for the hostages to be freed because, you know, made it this kind of almost like this sort of macho showdown between, you know, American will and Iranian will. And the Iranians weren't going to, you know, give in. And that was one of the really big structural shifts that went on in the period I'm writing about, that the news kind of became much less a function of building citizenship for democracy, and just one more center of profit and one more center of entertainment.
Along
those, pointed that out.
Yeah, along those lines again, and I'll repeat that. What I love about your writing of political history is you're capturing what else is going on at the nation at the time, which a lot of times we don't get. And again, having lived through that, it just brings back a lot of memories. But I love how you talk about these cultural changes and incorporate them.
That's
in the ongoing
how we experience politics,
history.
Right? It's like we don't, in our lives, we don't have a wall between politics and entertainment and economics and our families. You know, it's just life, right? And all these things affect each other, right? Like I write about Star Wars and how, you know, Hollywood, you know, was kind of offering up these very sort of almost like childlike visions of good versus evil, replacing the kind of the very much more mature kind of art cinema of the 1970s that had, you know, broken through movies like, you know, Last Tango in Paris and, you know, The Godfather and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And, you know, these were very Ronald Reagan-style movies.
The one that I thought made your point perfectly was in your first book on Dr. Strangelove. And the very real impact, the real impact it had on people's perceptions of what was going on, and talk about nuclear war.
Barry Goldwater, that was during the Republican New Hampshire primary, and the idea that these crazy military people, you know, had no compunctions about starting a war in order to kind of defeat the Soviet Union sounded a heck of a lot like what Barry Goldwater was saying in his famous book, Conscience of a Conservative, which sold millions of copies and launched his national political career. The whole last chapter is, you know, he says, quote unquote, a craven fear of death has creeped into America. By that, he meant people were too afraid to challenge the Soviet Union because it might lead to a nuclear war. And, you know, that was really scary. And of course, we all know it's one of the most famous kind of TV commercials in the history of politics. By the time Lyndon Johnson faced Barry Goldwater in the general election, his famous Daisy ad, right, in which a little girl was plucking a daisy and there was a countdown and a nuclear explosion blew up, and Lyndon Johnson came on, his voice came on the screen saying, "These are the stakes, we must love each other or die." And very famously, it ran only once. It was the first viral ad, right? Mm-hmm. Before the internet, it was a viral ad. They showed it on the news over and over again. They didn't have to pay to show it again. And that just kind of cemented the image of not only Barry Goldwater in 1964, but, you know, Ronald Reagan in 1980, because he was associated with Barry Goldwater. And, you know, that's what he had to overcome in order to get elected. So a lot of the melodrama I describe in his rise between 1976 and 1980 is his and his handler's attempt to kind of shave off the extremist edges, which hobbled Barry Goldwater. But sometimes they would come through, and Ronald Reagan would kind of speak off the cuff and say something crazy. And that became a big dynamic in his presidency as well. Of course, one of the ironies is Ronald Reagan turned out to be much more willing to negotiate aggressively with the Soviet Union than previous presidents. one of the reasons was, I think, he was so anti-communist, and he you know, so took seriously the idea that communists were trying to take over the world, that he believed it was absolutely imperative to try and ratchet down nuclear tensions because he thought that they might start a nuclear war.
I thought it was interesting in your latest book, too. Of course, you mentioned, I could mention these for a long time, but just a couple, All in the Family, but The Deer Hunter. That was really an interesting take. Rick, do you think this the cultural impact on movies and television and all, has it helped one party or the other more over this period?
I think during the period I'm writing about, the change in movies towards sort of more black and white images of good versus evil, traditional patriotism. We mentioned Star Wars. Another example was Superman, which was a big hit, in which basically an argument basically that America becomes too cynical and should, you know, Superman's real superpower was his kind of simple, uncomplicated patriotism, that is fighting for truth, justice, and the American way, which when in the first reel of the movie is treated as a laugh line, but kind of, you know, persuades the public, you know, by the last reel that this is really what we need. You know, someone like Superman or maybe like Ronald Reagan. The Deer Hunter that you mentioned is a movie in which basically it really kind of inverted the actual history of the Vietnam War to make it look like everything America did was innocent. And that longing for innocence, definitely in that period, which you saw kind of foreshadowed in popular culture, I'd say it kind of visited the box office before it visited the ballot box, helped Reagan. I think in other periods, I think that there was a lot of, you know, kind of very populist kind of cinema about, you know, businessmen being greedy bad guys, like It's a Wonderful Life in the 1930s, that certainly helped, you know, the New Deal.
Wall Street.
And Franklin Roosevelt. I think that there was a lot of wonderful cinema after the financial crisis that really helped kind of Barack Obama's reelection, this idea that there were, you know, names are escaping me, but there was a wonderful movie with George Clooney, you know, kind of like this was called a corporate whistleblower. You know, I think that popular culture has a huge role in, you know, how we kind of perceive politics, because in a democracy, politics is about what our vision is for what our country should be. It's a terrain of dreams, you know, it's a terrain of mythology. And the best politicians are the ones who kind of create a mythology around themselves. You know, Barack Obama's ability to kind of create this shimmering ideal of American unity. You know, Donald Trump's ability to create this kind of terror in his followers that, you know, like civilization is about to collapse, and without a hard man standing between you and the barbarians, you know, who knows might happen next. You know, this idea of American carnage.
Do you think, with the rise of the conservative movement, and you mentioned Jefferson Cowie's book, which I had him on as a guest, this post-World War II period when all the stars aligned, we had rise in middle income growth, yeah, and less income inequality. But do you think that's the exception in American history? Can we really recapture that? Or do you think liberalism's maybe run its course to some degree?
I think we're in a actually, I'm pretty optimistic. You know, I speak as a partisan liberal. I'm not ashamed of it. I like to say that, I like to think that my, you know, history is down the middle and people, you know, on both sides can appreciate it.
It is.
But certainly, one of the things that's very striking about Joe Biden inheriting the mess that he's inherited, that so much of the damage that Donald Trump has done is so self-evidently rooted in this kind of Reaganite kind of contempt for government and what government can do, right? And we have these kind of 450,000 deaths from COVID now. Yeah. You know, so much greater than, you know, kind of on a per capita basis than anywhere else in the country. And, you know, Joe Biden is kind of taking this opportunity, you know, of educating the public that, you know, we can do better, right? That we can distribute this vaccine. Grandparents are going to be able to hug their grandkids. And he's kind of using that as almost like a pivot point in people's minds, that if government can help us, you know, save lives in a pandemic, well, why can't it help us, you know, solve global warming? That was his big speech yesterday, right? And a lot of the people he's hiring to do this are people that have a lot more experience on kind of the activist left of the Democratic Party, you know, people from the labor movement, you know, people from the environment movement, than the sort of centrist kind of neoliberal Democrats who had those kind of powerful positions during the Clinton administration and during the Obama administration. And, you know, one of the things, you know, I talk about politicians as these kind of mystical creatures, that the best ones, you know, are they able to kind of deploy these kind of mythic storylines. And you know, Joe Biden's mythic storyline and his kind of superpower is his ability to kind of make everything he says sound perfectly reasonable. So if he says, you know, we need to completely reconstruct our power grid to use clean power sources, and this is the way to get, you know, good union jobs back and American prosperity back, you know, what it used to be, the kind of thing you would hear kind of in left-wing magazines, suddenly is the dead center of American politics.
We got about a minute left here, Rick. I covered about as much as I could within the time, but it's been fun. I got to ask you, do you plan to keep going in your series? I mean, I wish you'd leapfrog up to the Trump era, but are you going to take it sequentially?
Well, I do write a lot of journalism on Donald Trump. I mean, if you Google my name and Donald Trump, you'll find lots of articles in magazines like, you know, the New Republic and The Nation and In These Times. But I'm actually planning on writing my next big project will be a global history of the 1830s and how industrialism changed the world. So, you know, I'm a citizen first, so I'll always be writing about what's going on and trying to explain it to ordinary folks. That's my true passion.
All right. Well, I really appreciate your time today. Rick Perlstein's been our guest today. He's written probably one of the, if not the most definitive accounts of the rise of modern conservatism. I've had a lot of the authors on, and it's fun. These books are really great, folks. You like it. It intersects politics, history, culture, a lot of things. The latest book is called Reaganland. It weighs about 10 pounds, but it's worth every word. Rick, thank you so much for being our guest, and I hope to have you back sometime.
Certainly, Rob. Great pleasure. Cheers.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.